This is Rabbi Shai Held, Parashat Tazria Mitzora, 5775, Struggling with Stigma, Making Sense of the Mitzora. Modern readers often find the laws concerning Israelites, affected by tzara'at, a scaly skin disease, deeply disturbing. For thousands of years, people afflicted with diseases of the skin have suffered from stigma and social exclusion. So far from lightening the burden of stigma that the ailing are frequently made to bear, in this instance, the Torah seems only to intensify it. And yet, if we read both the text and the history of its interpretation closely, an at least somewhat more complex picture emerges. Chapters 13 and 14 of Leviticus deal with cases of transient and persistent tzara'at. One afflicted with the disease would be quarantined until it could be determined whether the illness was transient, in which case the sufferer could be declared pure and readmitted into the community, or persistent, in which case he or she would be excluded from the community for as long as the ailment persisted, which frequently meant for life. Why is so much attention paid to this particular ailment? How are we to understand the impulse to isolate the afflicted and remove them from the community? I have written elsewhere about Leviticus's passionate concern with creating an ordered haven within an often frighteningly chaotic world. Just as, in creating the world, God separated and ordered, so Israel is summoned to separate and order. By dividing sharply between permitted and forbidden foods, between permitted and forbidden sexual unions, and between life and death, Leviticus teaches, Israel engages in something godly. As Robert Alter notes, there is a single verb that focuses the major themes of Leviticus, divide, hivdil. Leviticus's focus on maintaining a stark divide between life and death is likely the key to understanding the laws governing the Mitzora, one afflicted with tzara'at. Bible scholar Tikva Feimer-Kensky explains that if the disease was at all similar to modern leprosy, its affect in an advanced state was similar to the decomposition of a corpse. The afflicted individual, like one who has been in contact with a corpse, might have been considered to be in a no-man's land between two realms, which must be kept rigidly apart. When Miriam is afflicted with leprosy after speaking ill of her brother Moses, Aaron asks Moses to pray on her behalf, tellingly pleading that their sister, quote, not be as one dead, who emerges from his mother's womb with half his flesh eaten away. For Leviticus, then, the Mitzora quite literally looks like death. The living dead conflate categories and blur boundaries, and are thus considered impure. The connection between tzara'at and death is subtly amplified by the biblical text. The Torah says of one afflicted with persistent tzara'at, quote, his clothes shall be rent, his head shall be left bare, and he shall cover his upper lip. All three of these practices are associated with mourning. Thus, for example, when Moses forbids Aaron and his sons from engaging in public rites of mourning, he instructs them, do not bare your heads, and do not rend your clothes. And when God orders the prophet Ezekiel not to mourn his losses, God tells him not to cover his upper lip. So, as Targum Yonatan notes, Leviticus charges the Mitzora to conduct himself like a mourner. But why? Since for Leviticus the Mitzora occupies an intolerably gray space between life and death, the Mitzora may be mourning his own death. Given Leviticus's concern to establish a stark boundary between life and death, all of this may be understandable, but it is nevertheless troubling. Should the Torah not mandate us to welcome and comfort the afflicted instead of isolating and expelling them? The Torah usually asks us to overcome our fears and visit the sick, so much so that for the sages, visiting the sick, Bikur Cholim, is a form of walking in God's ways. So how can we make sense of the dramatic and disturbing exception in the case of the Mitzora? I cannot pretend to offer a solution to this problem. I do not have one. But I do find it striking that the Torah seems deeply concerned to prevent permanent stigma being attached to one who has been afflicted by tzara'at. Bible scholar Tamara Eskenazi observes that after offering many details about the conditions that require separation and isolation, Leviticus also concentrates on reconnecting the persons who have been isolated and on bringing them back to the center. The more marginalized the old persons have been, the greater the effort to bring them back into the fold. Consider what happens as a transient Mitzora undergoes purification. Quote, the priest shall take some of the blood of the guilt offering and the priest shall put it on the ridge of the right ear of him who is being purified, on the thumb of his right hand, and on the big toe of his right foot. The priest then takes oil he has been handling, and, quote, some of the oil left in his palm shall be put by the priest on the ridge of the right ear of the one being purified, on the thumb of his right hand, and on the big toe of his right hand. This ritual of purification calls to mind the ceremony in which the priests are ordained. In the latter case, a ram is slaughtered and its blood is placed on the ridge of Aaron's and his son's right ears, on the thumbs of their right hands, and on the big toes of their right feet. Some of the blood that is upon the altar is intermingled with oil and sprinkled upon Aaron and his sons and on their vestments. This is what makes Aaron and his sons holy. What is the significance of this surprising parallel between the purification of the Metzorah and the ordination of the priests? Some scholars see only a formal link. Quote, in both cases, there is a transition. In the case of the Metzorah, it is from impure to pure. In the priestly case, it is from secular to holy. But Eskenazi sees something deeper at work. She suggests that Leviticus 14 illustrates the tremendous investment in the social and religious reconnection and rehabilitation of persons formerly stigmatized and excluded by virtue of the disease. The most marginalized, isolated person is reintegrated with an elaborate ritual, comparable only to that of the ordination of the high priest. The former Metzorah is thus welcomed back into the covenant community with open arms and unequivocal theological affirmation. And yet, as we've seen, some of the ill bear their affliction for life, and are thus permanently excluded from the camp. They are never welcomed back. In fact, some scholars see the persistent Metzorah's mourning as an expression of grief over his abiding isolation. As Gordon Wenham writes, it was little wonder that when a man was diagnosed as impure, he had to go into mourning. He experienced a living death. His life as a member of God's people experiencing God's blessing came to an end. As if the pain of his isolation were not enough, the Metzorah is also charged with helping ensure that it is not broken. In addition to carrying himself like a mourner, the Metzorah must, quote, call out, impure, impure. Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra explains that he must proclaim his own impurity constantly so that others are careful not to have any contact with him. Roy Gaines suggests that paradoxically, perhaps the Metzorah's funerary appearance intensified his need to call out while covering part of his face in order to clarify the nature of his mourning, so that others would not approach to comfort him. The plain sense of the text is clear. The Metzorah cries out in order to enforce his own isolation. But perhaps troubled by the seeming cruelty of the afflicted being made to bear such an excruciating and humiliating responsibility, some rabbinic interpreters understand the Metzorah's cries in radically different terms. He is bidden to call out, impure, impure, not to remind others to stay away, but to let them know of his suffering, so that they pray for mercy on his behalf. Note the audacity of this interpretation. The sages who offer it do not feel they can override a biblical mandate to isolate the Metzorah, but they can fundamentally transform the tenor of that isolation. The Metzorah is cast out, but decidedly not forgotten. This rabbinic interpretation profoundly alters the human dynamic that unfolds between the Metzorah and the rest of the community. It tries to elicit a deeper level of humanity both from the afflicted and from the community at large. A person who is ill may be tempted to withdraw psychologically. The one who is suffering from an illness so closely associated with death and impurity, all the more so. But the Torah invites him not to grant stigma and shame the final word. One who needs divine mercy should ask for it. And one who yearns to know that others care for him should ask for expressions of love and concern. Those who are unafflicted may be tempted to look down at those who are, to see those whose illness is suggestive of death as less than fully human, and thus as unworthy of their compassion. So the rabbinic interpretation of the Torah reminds them that the ill are no less human than the well. To be asked to pray for someone is to be charged with affirming their humanity totally and unconditionally, and with cultivating empathy for them. From a modern perspective, the laws concerning the Metzorah are troubling. I have tried not to gainsay or step around that simple fact. But a close reading of the text itself, and of the history of its interpretation, suggests a somewhat more complicated picture. The text stigmatizes the Metzorah, even as it tries to limit that very stigma. When the afflicted re-enters the community, His return is marked by a ceremony that validates him by associating him with the holy. Rabbinic interpretation goes one step further, reminding both the Metzora and the community that despite his illness and impurity, the Metzora is still a human being who deserves and is entitled to the care and concern of the community as a whole. Shabbat Shalom.